The Torah says, "Vayivnu ore miskinos leparo es pison vias Ramses." So the most of the Rishonim learn ore miskinos means that they built store cities. The Targum says base otzraya. But the Medrash says that miskinos can also be read miskenos, pitiful cities. That they built cities on sand, and when the cities were finished being built, they fell in, and they had to rebuild them. And this went on over and over. They built pitiful cities that didn't last, that had to constantly be rebuilt. What's the idea? Why would Paro have them build cities like that? The key, I think, lies in what is Avodas Perech. Paro made them work Avodas Perech. What exactly is Avodas? How much work is considered Perech, is considered breaking, back-breaking labor? Right? It breaks you. So there is a place where we can see exactly what Avodas Perech is. Because there's a halacha in the Torah, V'lo sirdenu beferech le'inecho. When you have an Eved Ivri, you can't make him work Avodas Perech. So there has to be a halachic definition of what's called Avodas Perech. The answer is that Avodas Perech is work that has no end to it or no purpose. They both really are the same. If there's no end, then you never see a purpose. You never see any benefit from the work. You just keep doing it over and over. Or work that in its essence has no purpose to it, just busy work. That's called Avodas Perech. The idea being that hard work is not necessarily negative. A person can work very, very hard, but he sees some tachlis of what he's doing, and he has some kind of not only benefit, but he sees a goal in what he's doing, right? An outcome. Then that kind of work can be exhilarating. You've accomplished something. You see an accomplishment. But if you work and work and see no accomplishment, you don't accomplish anything, then that work doesn't have to be that hard work, but it is, that work breaks you. Purpose of Paro was not merely to make them work. It was to make them work in a way that would break their spirit. And therefore he had them build cities where they felt no accomplishment, where they finished the city and it fell in, had to build it again, didn't accomplish anything. There's a story told of a Soviet prisoner, Siberia, who was imprisoned for 10 years. And there was a handle in the wall of his cell that he was told that he has to turn that handle 8 hours a day without a break. And he was told that on the other side of the wall was a mill, and by turning the handle, he was turning the mill and grinding wheat for Mother Russia. And this is what he did for 10 years. When they let him out, he asked to be able to see the mill that he was running for all these years by turning this handle. And the guards burst out into laughter, and they took him out around the other side of the wall, and they showed him that the handle was connected to nothing. For 10 years, he was turning a handle and accomplishing nothing. And he said that the knowledge that the handle was connected to nothing, and for 10 years he accomplished nothing, was more demeaning to him than the 10 years of imprisonment. That's Avodas Perech. The proof to this is in the end of the Seder. Paro gets wind that there's this Moshe and Aaron who are getting the people worked up about leaving Mitzrayim, speaking about freedom, and Paro wants to make sure that these winds and spirit of freedom is broken. So he says, let them work harder. Keep them busy. They don't have time to think. They won't have time to think about freedom. That's what the Mesillas Yesharim says. One of the biggest enemies of a person thinking and functioning properly is he doesn't have time. He's too busy. So Paro wants to make them work harder. So what does he say? I'm not going to give you any straw. You're going to have to go and get your own straw. And you're going to have to produce the same quota of bricks. Now, if I was Paro, I would have done something better. I would have told them, I'll continue giving you the straw, and you're going to have to produce double the quota of bricks you used to produce before. What would be better about that? Paro would get double the amount of bricks, and the people would be working twice as hard. But Paro's scheme doesn't seem to make sense. The people are working twice as hard, but he's gaining nothing from it. He gains no more bricks. Why didn't Paro act in a much smarter way and make them work harder where he would benefit more from it too? Here, there's no more benefit for Paro. The answer is that's exactly the point. Paro just didn't want them to work hard. He wanted them to work hard in a way that they felt no accomplishment, that their spirit would be broken. Because if he made them work harder and they saw that they produced double the amount of bricks, they'd feel a sense of accomplishment. And that wouldn't break their spirit, just the opposite. It would give them a feeling of accomplishment. It may enhance their spirit. So Bedafka, Paro made them work harder and see absolutely no more accomplishment. And that would break their spirit. That's Avodas Perach. It's interesting, the Sfarim bring down in a different context. They bring down that the word Perech in Esbash, if you transpose Aleph to Tav, Beis to Shin, and so on, so Perech becomes, Pei becomes Vav, Reish becomes Gimel, and Chaf becomes Lamed. Vav, Gimel, Lamed, Vogel. What does that mean? Nothing. But its numerical value is significant. Vav Gimel Lamed is Lamed Tes, 39. It hints to the Lamed Tes Malachas of Shabbos. The connection that I saw is different than I'm telling you. But in my estimation, it fits beautifully with this concept of Perech. Perech is work that has no accomplishment, that has no purposeless work. What is the antithesis of that? Esbash. If you transpose the antithesis of Perech, is the Lamed Tes Malachas of Shabbos. Because those are the 39 Malachas that went into building the Mishkan. There was no greater Meleches Macheves, purposeful work, than the Lamed Tes Malachas. So if you want to know what the antithesis of Perech is, transpose it to the opposite letters of the Aleph Beis, and you get the Lamed Tes Malachas of Shabbos, which were the Malachas of the Mishkan. That is the antithesis of Avodas Perech. Somebody told me today, and not only that, but the Malachas of Shabbos are what you don't do to accomplish to build a Shabbos. So sometimes not doing is a tremendous accomplishment. But in any case, those 39 Malachas were the Malachas HaMishkan. They're called Malachas Machsheves, tremendously purposeful, positive work. That is the opposite of what Avodas Perech is. Okay. Any questions on this? We'll go to the next thing. Okay, it says that Miriam waited to see what would happen with Moshe Rabbeinu when he was a little baby. And she was rewarded for that. What was Miriam's reward? That later on, when she became a Metzora, the entire Klal Yisrael waited for her for 7 days until she came back into the Machaneh. They were ready to leave, to break camp, and the Anan stopped, and they waited for Miriam to come back before they traveled, because she waited for her brother, they waited for her. What's the connection? If you follow the Midrashim with what Miriam did in concerning the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu, that's why she's called Miriam HaNeviyah, Achos Aaron. Her Neviyah was basically when Moshe wasn't born yet, when she was only the sister of Aaron. And the Midrashim say that when Paro decreed that all male children should be drowned, so Amram basically said, there's no reason for us to have children, that Paro should drown them. So he divorced his wife, Yocheved, and all of the other men followed suit. He was the Gadol Ador, and they all stopped living with their wives. Miriam went to her father. She was 6 years old, 5 years old. And she said, you are worse than Paro, because Paro will only drown the boys, but there can still be girls that are born, and some of the boys will survive. Some people will be able to hide their children. But if your Gzeirah is complete, there's not going to be any children. There's not going to be any future for Klal Yisrael. Her father realized that she was right, and because of this little five-year-old, and she said, besides that, I have a nevuah that you are going to have the Goel Yisrael. So, obeying his little five-year-old daughter, Amram, it says, patted her on the head, and he remarried Yocheved, and sure enough, they had a baby. And he said to Miriam, obviously, your nevuah is on the way to being fulfilled. They hid Moshe Rabbeinu for 3 months. They couldn't hide him anymore. They were forced to put him into the Yor, to at least be Mekayim, the Gzeirah of Paro, minimally, to be Yotze like that. And Amram gave up hope again. And he slapped Miriam across the face, the Medrash says, and he said to her, where's your nevuah? Obviously, it's not going to be. And Miriam didn't give up, and she waited to see what would be Moshe Rabbeinu, and sure enough, she was the one who suggested to Bas Paro to bring Moshe's own mother to nurse him. What is the Mida that Miriam HaNeviyah represented? The name Miriam itself represents Vayimoru Es Chayehem, the worst portion of Avdus Mitzrayim was the last 86 years. And that 86 years was during Miriam's lifetime. And she never gave up hope. That was the Midah of Miriam. Where others gave up hope, the Gedolim gave up hope, Miriam never gave up hope. She waited anxiously to see what would happen to Moshe. She had bitachon, emuna, that it would work out. When her father gave up hope and stopped having children, she gave him mussar. Miriam's midah was, don't be miyayish. It says in Pirkei Avos, al tisyayish min apuronios. No matter how bad things are, don't give up hope. The Gemara says that even if a sharp sword is already on your neck, don't give up hope. There's always hope. In fact, not giving up hope makes the Yeshua more possible. When you give up hope, then the chances of the Yeshua coming are less. The reason being, Yiyush is a halachic concept. If you lose something, if you haven't been miyayish, you didn't give up hope of finding it, then if somebody finds it, they have to return it to you. But if you gave up hope of finding it, then you sever your connection with the thing. When you lose it, you sever your actual connection. You're not connected to it anymore. You lost it. What connects you to it? Your desire to get it back. That keeps you connected to it. As soon as you give up hope, you sever your connection to that thing completely. It's not yours anymore. And anybody who finds it from that point on can keep it. So Yiyush, not being Miyayish, not giving up hope, gives you a connection to the thing. If there's a Yeshua in the background, in the wings, as long as you haven't given up hope on it, you're still connected to it. If you've given up hope on the Yeshua, you've severed your connection with it, and that makes it more difficult for it to come. So just not giving up hope helps the Yeshua to come. With that, I want to explain a very difficult Gemara. The Gemara says that Mashiach will not come ad sheyisyaishu min ha-geula, until we give up hope of the geula coming. Now, on the surface, that seems to be extremely difficult, since there's a mitzvah of achak elo b'chol yom sheyavo. How can Klal Yisrael ever come to a time when they'll give up hope? They won't be mekayim the mitzvah of achak elo b'chol yom sheyavo, and only because we gave up hope will Mashiach come? So I want to explain it in the following way. It says that all of the geulas that have happened already have happened through the agency of human beings. Geulas Mitzrayim, Moshe and Aaron, Geulas Shivas Tzion, Ezra, HaSofer, and Nehemiah. Yoshua was involved in the Bi'as Ha'aretz and so on. Mashiach, and because they happened through human agency, they couldn't be eternal. Whatever a human being accomplishes can't be eternal. A human being isn't eternal. So they were all temporary. The final geula will be eternal because it will happen directly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu without any human intervention. Even though Mashiach will be, but Mashiach will be the Rabban Shalom's representative. He won't bring the geula. The geula will come from the Rabban Shalom, and Mashiach will be Melech who will rule during that time. He's not going to bring the geula. Mashiach's not going to bring geula. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will. And therefore, the geula will be eternal. Now, if that's the case, if we have the feeling that we can bring the geula, then we are connected to that geula. Because not giving up hope of something connects you to it. And if we feel that we could bring the geula, we can redeem ourselves, then we have a connection to that geula. And if we have a connection, then the geula will not be totally at the hands of heaven, but will be with our connection too, just the fact that we didn't give up on it. So the geula won't come until we give up hope of bringing it ourselves, of having a hand in that geula. We won't give up hope that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will bring the geula, but we'll give up hope of our being able to do it with natural means. Because as long as we haven't given up that hope, we're connected to the geula with natural means, and then when the geula comes, it's not going to come totally al yidei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's going to come connected to our natural means because of what we didn't give it up. So until we give up a feeling of bringing the geula on our own and realize that the final geula is going to come totally from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Mashiach won't come. Because if it'll come before we give up hope, we'll have a connection to it and it'll destroy the ability for it to be permanent. One last thing, and then I'll take your questions. Memela, that was the schus that Miriam had. Miriam represented not giving up hope. If that's the case, in the Midbar, wherever they were delayed, there was always the chance that they'd give up hope. We know constantly in the Midbar. They didn't have water, they didn't have food, they didn't have this, they didn't have that. They constantly were complaining. Constantly have had a lack of bitachon in the Rabbanu Shalom. And the more they were delayed in the Midbar, so the more the chance that they would give up hope. But waiting for Miriam, the Rabbanu Shalom said, can't generate giving up hope. because Miriam is the epitome. She is the archetype, the symbol of not giving up hope. So waiting for her can't generate giving up hope. Therefore, it's okay to wait for Miriam 7 days in the Midbar. It won't bring Klal Yisrael to Yiyush, because Miriam was a symbol of not being Miyayish. That's what it means. Because Miriam waited for Moshe and exhibited that tremendous midah of not giving up hope, Klal Yisrael were able to wait for her, and there was no chashash that the waiting of 7 days would bring them to Yiyush, because waiting for Miriam couldn't possibly bring a Yiyush, since she was a symbol of the antithesis of Yiyush. Okay. Now, any questions? Yeah. Okay. That's an excellent question, but it doesn't contradict what I said. I have a whole piece of Torah that I wasn't sure if I should say today or next week or the week after that or the week after that, because it applies to all of the parashios. I'm not going to say it today, even though you're tempting me. I'm going to hold it for one of the other parashios, because I have other, many more things to say today. It's based on the fact that in this week's Sedra, and again in next week's Sedra, and again in the week after that Sedra, Moshe Rabbeinu tells Paro a lie. They want to go 3 days in the desert and make sacrifices. It was not true. They wanted to leave forever. They never had a havamin of coming back to Mitzrayim after 3 days. So why the lie? There are many answers. The answer I want to give is connected to your question. But I'm going to answer your question anyway, hopefully not give away what I'm going to say on this other question. We don't bring Geula. We deserve it. We have to do things to deserve HaKadosh Baruch Hu being Goelus. But we're not the Goelim. We don't redeem ourselves. We set the stage where we are fit to be redeemed. But ultimately, HaKadosh Baruch Hu redeems us. That's the difference. So even in the Geula Vachishena, where we can bring the Geula earlier, we're not bringing the Geula. We are setting the stage where we deserve HaKadosh Baruch Hu to bring it earlier. That's the difference. Okay. Above giving up. Okay. It doesn't contradict the thing. Again, we're never going to give up the feeling that Mashiach's going to come. What we're going to give up is the feeling that we can bring it up with our own means. That's what it means. Yishayishu min ha-geula. We're going to give up the thought that we can bring it, that we can redeem ourselves. And until we give up that thought, if Mashiach comes where we still are connected, thinking we can bring it, then to a certain degree we're connected to that, and it's not going to be totally in the hands of the Ribbono Shel Olam. There was one more question? Yeah. All right, hold that question for when I get to the what I wanted to speak about. Okay, the 3 days in the Mizbar. Okay. That will include what your answer to your question. Yeah. First of all, she had a nevuah. Right? She wasn't just a little precocious 5-year-old. She was a nevuah. So she felt that she had a mandate from a higher source that Amram also had to listen to, right? So she had what to say to him. She had a nevuah, she had a shlichus to him. So it's not just, you know, a little girl telling her father what to do with his marriage. That's the real answer. Beyond that, obviously, if she was roy to have a nevuah at 5 years old, she wasn't just a cute little 5-year-old, right? She was a special young lady. And she felt that her father was doing something wrong, and the halacha is that even if it's your parent, you have a chiyuv to give them musar and tochacha with respect. But with respect. But you have to give them musar also. And I'm sure she did it with a great amount of respect, but she felt her father was doing something not only wrong, but was bringing Klal Yisrael to do something terribly wrong. And if you feel your parents are doing something that is devastating, not only to them, but to others also, then you have to find the way to let them know in a respectful way, but you can't keep your mouth shut either. That much you can learn from Miriam. Okay. It says that when Paro commanded the Mialdos to drown the boys, so it says, Vatirena ha-Mialdos esu elukin v'lo asu kashu dibra aleh melech Mitzrayim. The Mialdos feared God, and they didn't do what Paro said. They didn't drown the little. They didn't kill the little boys by birth. So the Telzer Rosh Yeshiva asks, "Do you have to be a God-fearing person not to kill babies? You have to be a human being. You have to be civilized. A lot of atheists don't go around killing babies. You have to be a civilized person." So why does the Torah say, Vatirena ha-Mialdos esu Elokim, because they feared God, that's why they didn't kill the little babies. He says, you see from here, that if you don't have fear of God, but you are a moral person, that's not going to stop you from killing babies. Because if there's no fear of God, and it's based on your morality, your understanding, then you can change your morality from day to night and make it moral to kill little babies if it suits your purpose. The Nazis did it. They just decided that Jewish babies are not fit to live. They're like cockroaches, and just like there's nothing wrong with killing a cockroach, there's nothing wrong with killing a Jewish baby. And they convinced an entire nation, or at least their Nazis, to follow suit, and there was no compunctions. Many of them had no moral problem with killing little babies, because morality says it's, you can change your morality. Human morality is based on what a person feels. You can change your feeling from day to night. And unless you fear God, and unless God tells you it's okay to kill babies, which sometimes he does, like the Shiva So'amim or Amalek, then the Rabban Shem also says. And the only difference between somebody who does it because his whim tells him to do it and somebody who does it because the Rabban Shem said to do it is God said. And if they claim that God told them to do it, then we'll wait and see who God told. There's really no other difference. But if you base your morality on logic, then logic can change from day to night. The proof? Sodom. Sodom was not an immoral, lawless place. They had laws. They had a system of morality, except their morality was immoral. Famous Maisa. The Medrash brings down. That's cute, but it brings across a tremendously important lesson. Eliezer, Eved Avraham, went to Sodom, and he got mugged. Somebody beat him up. But he was a gibor, so he got up, and he chased his assailant, and he caught him. And he dragged him to court. And the judges, the Gemara says, in the courts, were named Sheker, Vechazov, those are the names of the judges. So Eliezer appeared before the judge with his assailant, and the judge said, "What do you want?" He said, "I want justice. This man mugged me. I want justice done." So the judge said to him, "Did he cause you to bleed?" So Eliezer said, "Yes." He said, "Okay, we charge $50 for bloodletting in this country. So please pay him $50 for doing you the service of bloodletting." Eliezer wasn't stupid. So he punched the judge in the face, made him bleed, and said, "Whatever you owe me, pay him." It's a cute story. What's it mean? What it means is that Sodom was not a lawless place. They had laws. But the laws were corrupt. That's Mishpatei B'nei Adam. People can create morality from immorality. In the 1960s in America, there was the sexual revolution on the college campuses. And they created a new morality. It's very interesting that the new morality was very, very similar to the old immorality. But if you call it new morality, all of a sudden you can change what was yesterday immoral. Today make it moral, just call it a different name. Now it's okay to be immoral. We'll just call it the new morality. People can justify murdering little children if it suits their their needs. So therefore, in order not to kill little children, you have to be a God-fearing person. That's what Tirena HaMialos. That's what Avraham Avinu said to Avimelech. Avimelech was a righteous king. He was Zocha, the Rebbeim spoke to him. But he asked Avraham, why did you lie and say it's your sister? What did you see here that you were afraid? And he said, Raki ein yiras Elokim b'mokom hazeh, you are all fine, moral people. But it doesn't come from a fear of God by the populace. And therefore, v'harguni al dvarishti, they're capable of murdering me for my wife. Because tomorrow they'll make it moral to murder somebody for his wife. If it's not based on Yiras Shamayim. That's the idea. Okay, any questions on that? Yes. Right. In other words, the only difference, they asked that question. Why are we different than Hitler? Hitler committed genocide on Jews. We committed genocide on Amalek and on the Shiva So'amim. There's no answer to that question except we didn't do it because we redefined our moral system. We did it because God said to do it and we have no choice. God defines our moral system. But if we did it because we decided on our own, then that's immoral.
But is it any bayon fact, or it shouldn't even be?
Once we know that Avraham Avinu had a nevuah to himself, here we have a Torah that we know that everything in the Torah is true because we witnessed Moshe Rabbeinu getting the nevuah by the Aseres Hadibros as a nation. So it's not so much an assayin, it's only an assayin of believing in the Torah. But once you believe in the Torah, then the Torah defines your morals. I'm not doing it because I think it's moral. I may think it's not moral at all, but the Rebbeim Hashem told me in this situation it is. But if I'm doing it because in my eyes this is a moral thing to do, then there's nothing that I can't do. Just a matter of what I need to do and what suits my needs, and anything can become moral. Yes and no. According to some opinions, that which Goyim have to make a courts of law isn't totally dependent on their logic and their morality. But the Rebbeinu Shel Olam gave over halachas, and there are. The Gemara discusses the details of the halachas of the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach. Who's that for? Goyim are supposed to come to a Jewish Beis Din and ask Shilas. In their halachas. A goy who accepts Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach to do it because the Rebbeinu Shel Olam said in the Torah to do it, and that's the way that will get Olam Haba for it, the Rambam says. So he has to come to Chachmei Yisrael and ask them his shailas of what is the Mesorah that you have in my Sheva Mitzvahs. So not everybody holds like that, but it's much easier to understand like that. next, it says, "Vayigdal hayeled." Moshe Rabbeinu grew up. Next pasuk says, "Vayigdal Moshe." So the Ramban says the first one is that he grew up physically; he became a mature person physically, and the second one, "Vayigdal Moshe," became a gadol, matured emotionally and spiritually. What was Koveya, Moshe Rabbeinu's maturity? When did he become a mature, emotional, spiritual person? So the Torah says, Vayetze Alecha Vayar B'Sivlosam. When he went out to his brothers and he saw, Rashi says, Nosan and Eina V'Libo Lios Meitzer Aleim. He put his eyes and his heart to suffer along with them. He felt their pain. That's when he became a godel. That is godless. In 1 second, I'll explain to you why. But Rashi says you need two things to be a godel like that. You need a nayim and lev. A nayim means you intellectually have to know what somebody else needs. You have to feel what they need intellectually. And you need a heart to feel it emotionally. You have to have an eyes and a heart intellectually to know what their needs are and emotionally. Neither one by itself is enough. Because if you emotionally feel for somebody's needs, but you don't have the intellectual understanding of what they are, you may harm a person. You may have a drug addict begging you to help him, drugs, when the best thing is to deny him that and to help him get help to clean himself of the drugs. So you may have a tremendous heart of helping somebody, but if you don't have the brains to know how to do it, you may do more harm than good. On the other hand, if you have the brains to know what a person needs, but you don't have any heart, and you have no emotional feeling, you may understand it and make studies about it, but you may not do anything about it because you don't feel. Thank you. Who does this belong to? Huh? But it was meant here for the teachers. Or? We'll leave it. I don't need it. It's okay. Thank you. So that's godless. That's being a great person, being able to emotionally and intellectually empathize with somebody. Why is that called a godel? So I think perhaps the reason is the following. Rav Shimon Shkop, in his Hakdama to his Sefer Shara Yosher, asks the following question. He says that people have a big dilemma and a conflict because we are mandated by the Torah to have self-concern. We're supposed to be concerned about ourselves. First, you come first in every area. If you need tzedakah and somebody else needs tzedakah and you have enough money for yourself, you have to keep it for yourself. If you have something getting lost, and your father or your Rebbe has something getting lost, you come first. You save your article, and then only after that theirs. If your life is in danger, and you can save your life, and somebody else's life is in danger, and if you save yours, then they're going to die, you come first. So you always come first. Chayecha kodmi. So the Torah mandates self-concern. Yet the Torah says you can't only be concerned about yourself, yeah? Yeah, if it's you or them, it's not something that you could work out in such a way that you won't suffer that much and they'll benefit. Yeah, you come first.
Right.
If your physical life comes first, surely your spiritual life comes first. It's more important. That's the case, right. And you have a canteen of water, and if you drink it, you'll survive, and if you share it with somebody else, you'll both die. You drink it. Again. What's the case? Yeah. Are they alive or dead? No. If they're alive, that's called murder. What? Oh, you just want to cut off their leg. You don't want to kill them. Yeah, you come first when it's your thing. You don't come first with somebody else's leg. They come first with their leg. Different case. The case of the canteen is not where the other guy has the canteen and I come first and I can steal his canteen. He comes first and he gets to drink the water of his canteen. It's only if it's my canteen, I don't have to share it with him. If we're both going to die, I drink it all and I live. But if it's not my canteen, I can't take his because I come first. I come first with my canteen. I may be able to cut off my leg, but I can't cut off his leg. You come first. Kibud Avraham, you don't even have to honor your parents if it costs you money. It has to be with their money. Surely not where you're giving up your life to be mechabed your parents. Okay, in any case, this was not the ikar of the thing. Let's get past that. What? Parents are willing to give up life for their children. It's a shaila whether a person is allowed to do that. It's a shaila. If somebody did it, you wouldn't consider them a suicide. But if somebody came to ask a shaila, it's not so simple. Yeah, but I hear, but those were not physical things. Those were like spiritual things or whatever. It's a different story. Okay. In any case, so on the other hand, we're not supposed to just worry about ourselves. We're supposed to worry about other people too. So how do you balance these two concerns? Self-concern and concern for others. Says Reb Shimon, somebody who considers himself from his toes to his head and everybody else is somebody else has a big problem because he has a conflict between self-concern and concern for everybody else. But there are people who are bigger than that. People who consider their spouse part of them. And when they're concerned about their spouse, they're not concerned about somebody else. That's self-concern. Except their self is two bodies, themselves and their spouse. Some people are bigger than that, and they consider all their children part of them. So when they're concerned about their children, not concerned about somebody else, that's also self-concern. Some people consider all their relatives part and parcel of them. So when they're concerned about their extended family, it's self-concern. Some people consider their entire neighborhood, city, country, all of Klal Yisrael part of them. So then there's no problem. It's all self-concern. Then the only problem is, which part of me is the priority? Do I worry about my leg, my arm, my head, or this part of me, that part of me? We're all part of me. It's all self-concern. So it's just a matter of priorities. That's much easier. It's less of a conflict than me or them. Which part of me? The proof to that is by Yaakov Avinu's stone. 12 stones argue. They all want Yaakov's head on them. So what does HaKadosh Baruch Hu do? Fuse them all together. But still the same problem. Yaakov's head didn't get any bigger. So his head's only going to fit on 1/12 of the stone. Why aren't they still arguing? The answer is once it's all one stone, what difference does it make which part of the stone? It's all the same stone. So it makes a difference if it's this part or that part, it's all the same stone. Same thing, if it's all me, then the major difference is only priorities. It's not me or you, it's all me, which part of me. It's much less of a conflict. That's godless. Somebody who can feel part of other people. Not just sympathize with them, but empathize with them. Feel their tzar as if it's his. That's a godel. That's what real godless is. And why we call a godel be Israel, somebody who knows a lot of Torah, because in order to have the chachma and the emotion, you have to know, talk a lot of Torah, to be able to identify with other people. But a godel is a godel because he identifies with people, because he feels what they feel. The Torah brings him to that. But the ultimate godless is being able to feel what other people need. I was thinking and he says that's what it means in Pirkei Avos, im ein ani li mi li, kshani li atzmi mo ani. If I'm not for myself, who's going to be for me? I have to worry about myself, self-concern. But kshani li atzmi, when my ani is just little old me, from my head to my toes, mo ani, that's not my ani. My ani has to encompass everybody. And I'm thinking to add to that, and we'll end with this, the word ani symbolizes that. Ani on one side is an aleph, the individual. On the other side is a yud, the community. How do you connect the aleph and the yud and make that your ani? You and everybody else, and that becomes you. You need the nun in the middle. The nun represents chamishim shari bina and chamishim shari tahara. You need a lot of emotion, of purity, and a lot of chachma, the 50 gates, if you put that nun in the middle, you can connect the aleph and the yod, the yochid and the tzibur, and make that your ani, that becomes you. That's what ani represents. Okay.